Campus FM presents a lecture organized by the Department of Public Law. This is an interview which Judge Dr. Giovanni Bonello gave to Dr. Tonio Azzopardi.
Good afternoon. We are indeed privileged to have with us today Judge Giovanni Bonello, who has carved his name with pride at Strasbourg in the European Court of Human Rights. Judge Bonello is very well known for his dissenting opinions, but naturally, he also has played a very important role in inducing a change in the philosophy of the European Court of Human Rights with regards to the majority decisions as well. So we have also important concurring opinions by Judge Giovanni Bonello. Judge Bonello, I welcome you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Perhaps you can, let's start off this discussion or interview by giving us an idea of how you joined the legal profession and what area of practice did you first embrace before moving on to human rights law?
I joined the legal profession most unwillingly. I never wanted to be a lawyer. My family had a divided soul. We had on one side historians and on the other lawyers, and I was very much on the side of the historians, not the lawyers. But eventually my family shoved me into the law course and I found myself there. I must say from the outset that I was never interested in criminal law. I respect criminal lawyers and I have no problems with that, but I was always more tuned to academia in the sense that I consider, again, probably wrongly, that civil law is much more challenging than criminal law. Criminal law is you have to have a good smattering of law and then be a salesman. While in civil law, you have to really use your grey matter to the utmost. And that is much more of a challenge. So you'll all be lawyers one day and you'll do in the beginning, everything that comes your way. You'll be more or less on the starving line, and whatever comes your way, you'll accept with great gratitude. But eventually, you'll become a little more choosy, more selective. And some of you will go in for commercial law, some of you will go for company law, some of you will go for criminal law. I opted for civil law. But then circumstances demanded that somebody take an interest in human rights law. Human rights were introduced as an actionable right in Malta in 1961. At first, nobody noticed that this was a major revolution. It took time to sink in that something was more important than Parliament, something was more important than the Supreme Court, something was more important than anything else, which is the rule of human rights. The respect for human rights overrides everything. And at first, I think that neither the judiciary nor the legal profession took in this huge upheaval that it now is no longer what the civil code says. If the civil code is not in conformity with human rights, forget the civil code. There is an overriding rule to any other norm which was accepted as supreme, as sovereign. And I thought this was a fantastic challenge, that you try to introduce human rights into the texture of everyday society. I remember it was an uphill struggle. I remember when I had my first freedom of expression case, it was about a person in a peaceful demonstration who was holding a poster, and the police went, grabbed the poster and tore it up. And I instituted a human rights case based on freedom of expression. And I remember the judge was very, very puzzled. And after I had done all my pleadings, he said, "How much does the poster cost?" Well, I said, "Probably 1 cent." "So all this fuss about 1 cent," he said. "All this fuss about 1 cent. The dimension of me having the right to go around with a poster saying something which was not very pleasant to the authorities, and a policeman coming and just cold-bloodedly and tearing it off and throwing it in my face, did not strike him as that it had a much more profound dimension then the mere cost of a piece of paper. So that was the beginning. I could recount a number of these episodes, but that I think exemplifies how difficult it was at first to convince the judiciary and people around you that we're talking a different language altogether.
So by 1987 you had already handled over 100 constitutional cases, if not more. Many of them on behalf of a political party that was in opposition at the time. Mm-hmm. And many others on behalf of aggrieved individuals like Father Philip Galea. Mm-hmm. Apart from De Micoli versus Malta, which you highlighted in a recent interview, which are the ones that you consider the most far-reaching locally?
There were a number of cases. I mean, in all, I believe I've handled about 170 human rights cases as a lawyer, not as a judge, as a lawyer. And in 170, there's a huge spectrum of possibilities. Anything from torture to freedom of expression, from family law, from rights of family to anything else. So I think I dipped my finger in virtually all the human rights at that time. Which were they? Oh, there were many cases of freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, family rights, fair trial. These are all the fundamental rights which you come across. Today, the general agenda has changed. In the beginning, we were dealing with core human rights. Article 2, Article 3, right to life, right to be exempt from torture and human degrading treatment, the basic right of freedom of assembly. Today it's much more sophisticated. Today we are on the periphery of human rights. Thankfully, the human rights situation has improved enormously in the sense that there are less core violations. There will always be violations, even in the best ordered society, like what we consider the cradle of human rights, which are France and the United Kingdom. They still have a huge amount of complaints against them, number of them successful complaints, which shows that human rights were, are, and will always be in danger, will always be a delicate subject which needs constant protection, constant watching over. Yes, I mean, there are many ways of concern for human rights that the authorities do not violate human rights, that in place there are the proper protections to avoid the violations of human rights, that once they are avoided, you get the right judicial protection and redress. I think we have improved on all fronts. Don't want to repeat, fewer violations of human rights, less grievous violations of human rights. Judicial protection, my personal view is that it still needs more. Our courts do their best. The local courts have improved their sensitivity to the protection of human rights. We are no longer in the stage where a judge asks you how much a poster costs. So, but my personal view is that it is still rather worrying. One statistic, which I'm not sure I should be quoting, is that so far the European Court of Human Rights has delivered 31 judgments in Maltese cases, 31 judgments, which were brought to the attention of the. In 30 out of 31, the European Court reversed the judgment of the Constitutional Court of Malta, 30 out of 31, which means that Strasbourg thought that the Maltese courts had got it all wrong. And that is very worrying. It is a very, very a statistic which to me gives rise to major concern. We're not talking of 50%, we're talking of probably 96% of the cases which Strasbourg had to revisit were considered to have been wrongly decided by the Maltese courts.
In that same interview, which was published in the Sunday Times a little while ago, you stated, the European Court has adopted a two-pronged philosophy, European consensus and marginal appreciation. Can you elaborate further on the philosophy of the European Court of Human Rights during your tenure, especially on the marginal appreciation, which was first mentioned in the Handicide case?
Yes. So, there obviously isn't a manual of human rights or a computer program where you push the right buttons and the answer comes out. The European Court of Human Rights is, in other words, the Supreme Court of Europe. It has the right to overrule everything in the whole of the European space which it believes is not in conformity with human rights. So it's dealing with a very incohesive panorama. You have the Nordic states, you have the Muslim states, you have the Latin states, you have the those which belong to the to common law, the others which are more on Roman law, on civil law. So it has to be an umbrella which covers a huge amount of variables. Some easy to reconcile, others extremely difficult to reconcile. So being a European court, one of its priorities is how to harmonize European concepts, norms, as far as possible. That is possible to a certain extent. So whenever possible, the European Court of Human Rights will take inspiration from what happens generally in Europe, what is considered to be a good norm, a minimum standard throughout the whole of Europe. One of the arguments repeatedly used by the European Court of Human Rights is the European consensus. Let's look around us and see whether how the majority of European states have tackled the issue. And that gives good results in a large number of cases, because it relies on an objective standard. The great majority have decided that this is the right way of doing things. And it is not bad to impose that majority view on the others, the few others who have not accepted it. That is the European consensus side. But the European Court of Human Rights recognizes that there are areas which cannot fall under the European consensus because they depend very much on local factors, on different cultures, different religious views, different customs, different political approaches, which are very difficult to reconcile and which is not right to impose on one on the other. Let's take the concept of obscenity or of indecency. You will immediately realize that Europe is a huge, vast conglomeration of people. I think we are about 800 million in Europe, which range from Portugal to the frontier of China, from Iceland to Greece. You can't expect to have the same concept of what is decent or indecent, or what is obscene and what is not obscene, throughout the whole spectrum. Obviously, showing your elbow in Azerbaijan could be considered indecent. Covering it would be considered indecent in Finland, probably. So you have this great difficulty of reconciling what are very intimate notions related to morality. Not only morality, but principally the problem arises in questions of morality. And there you get the European Court uses its trump card. It says, this is an area that falls within the margin of appreciation of every individual state, and it is for the local state to regulate this matter. Film censorship, I'm inventing. Obviously, if you accept the concept of censorship, which some do and some don't, what are the criteria? Should the criteria be the same in Portugal as they are in Latvia? No, obviously not, because morality is something which is imbued with tradition, with values, with views, with worldviews, with philosophies, which necessarily vary enormously from one country to the other. And so there you have the two, sometimes they're in conflict. One of the cases that will soon be decided is the abortion cases in Ireland. And there will be a major conflict between one and the other, because virtually every country in Europe, except for Ireland, Malta, San Marino and Andorra, have legislated for regulated abortion. So, except for these countries, these four which I mentioned, the other 43 countries in Europe, all have in place legislation which permits abortion in limited cases when the life of the mother is at risk, when the health of the mother is at risk, and in very few other circumstances. Now, will the court go by the European consensus? If it does, so abortion is forced on Ireland. If it goes by the margin of appreciation, it will say abortion is one of these highly sensitive matters which it is best to leave to the local authorities to regulate. What will the answer be? I know the answer, but I won't tell you. It will be, in January, when the judgment will be issued. Incidentally, just to give an idea what the European Court, and if you don't mind, I'll just go a bit on the side, what the European Court of Human Rights deals with. I finished my stint there in October, but the rule is that in appeal cases, a judge who has started the appeal has to carry it through to the conclusion. And I'm left with three cases pending. One of them is the abortion cases I've spoken about, very high profile, extremely sensitive, difficult case. For My Sins, another one is the crucifix in schools. I'm in it too, you probably heard about it because it was the most highly mediatized case I think the court has had in 60 years of existence. It's the one that received most media praise or the other word. When the first hall for the first level of jurisdiction found that the presence of a crucifix in Italian classrooms is a violation of the convention. The government appealed and the court has now to revisit this case, a case which technically is only relevant to Italy, but it is by reflex, it is relevant to Malta, it is relevant to Greece, it is relevant to the south of Spain. It is, anyway, something that has raised a huge amount of controversy and of debate. That, too, I believe, will be decided in January or February. All the deliberations have been done, and then that will be decided. The third case I'm in, it hasn't hit the headlines as well as these other two and many others, but I believe that this is much more fundamental. This relates to atrocities, killings, torture, allegedly committed by the armed forces of Great Britain in Iraq. It is alleged that a number of civilians, not war, we're not talking of war, civilians were killed, raped, tortured by British soldiers during the campaign, the Iraq occupation, in the Basra region, which was within the jurisdiction of, or rather within the control of the United Kingdom. So these people sued the families, because they're all dead, six of them are killed, sued in the British courts, and the British courts said that, no, Britain is bound by the convention, by its obligations under the convention, only within the territory of the United Kingdom, or wherever it has expressly extended the jurisdiction. The relatives of the victims were not satisfied with these judgments by the British courts, and have passed the baby over to Strasbourg to decide this very fundamental question, whether an occupying country carries the convention with it. if it carries war, if it carries occupation, does it also carry the guarantees against war, against the abuse of it? This will also be decided early next year. So that gives you a spectrum of what sort of cases are dealt with by the European Court of Human Rights.
What impact do the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights have on new member states from Eastern Europe that have a poor human rights record, a fragile rule of law, and an unstable political system? Does the court use the margin of appreciation doctrine to lower its standards?
Absolutely not. The margin of appreciation is only used, as I tried to explain before, in areas where it is considered that it is that the local authorities are better placed to decide an issue rather than an international court, which is far away and not in such close contact with the nitty-gritty of everyday life. It does not have double standards for the old democracies and the new democracies. The new democracies are expected to pull their socks up and to come up to scratch. And when they don't, except in the limited cases where the margin of appreciation allow, then they are found to be in violation of the convention. This is one of the things that the court is very conscious of. And there was a sort of feeling, thankfully it never crystallized, by which it was thought these are just finding their feet, give them a chance, slowly, gradually, don't expect too much of them from the beginning. This was discarded. If you join the convention, if you ratify the convention, then you have to respect convention standards. And I don't believe that because a country had torture which was endemic in the system of interrogations like Turkey and Russia, then they should get, or they do get, any preferential treatment because they've always had it or because they're new democracies or whatever they are. No, the answer is a very definite no. And I'm glad that it is a very different now.
Positive obligations. There is no reference to positive obligations in the European Convention. Yet the court applies this doctrine in a large number of judgments in order to increase the protection for the individual. How does the court apply this doctrine in practice?
Well, that is one of the major breakthroughs of judge-made law. You know, the convention just has one sentence, no one shall be subject, everybody is entitled to. And at first, it was thought that the convention basically prohibited the states, it was a negative obligation, not to do something to interfere with your human rights. And that was the traditional, conventional way of reading the convention. You have the right to life, so that means that the state shall not deprive you of your life. That was found to be unsatisfactory. And the court invented, I'm not shy of saying that, it invented the parallel rule that if there is a negative obligation, there is also, in most cases, a positive obligation for the state to do something, not simply to refrain from doing something, but to do something. So I started off with the right to life. The right to life says, okay, the state or its agents shall not deprive a person unlawfully of his life. Is that enough? No, definitely not. There are positive obligations linked to that. If a person has been deprived of his life in suspicious circumstances, the state has the obligation to investigate that taking away of life or the torture or whatever it is. There is a positive obligation to investigate. Plus, does the state has to have in place the right mechanisms, the right safeguards to ensure that life is not taken away illegally. It's a positive obligation. We've had a number of cases where some person is persecuted, reports to the police that he's had death threats, he has been threatened with death or with violence, and the police just take down the note and file it there. When something serious happened, the court found that, in the right circumstances of course, that the state had a positive obligation to act on a threat to life. If there is a threat to life, credible threat to life. It's not enough that the policeman takes a report and files it. It has to take positive obligation to take positive steps to protect life. This is life, this is family, this is virtually all the rights, not all, but most of the rights, have a parallel obligation of what the state is obliged to put in place or to do once there is a threat to the enjoyment of the fundamental right. So this is one of the areas where the case law of the court has exploded, and in my very humble belief, rightly so, that the court is not there only to judge after a human right has been violated. It is there to see that the state has in place the right mechanisms, the right procedure, the right form of mind to prevent the violation of human rights.
Proportionality. The principle of proportionality forms an integral part of the philosophy of the European Court, just as much as the concept of a disproportionate burden or a disproportionate hindrance is an important tool in the hands of the European Court. Could you illustrate the application of these concepts?
Illustrate may be not the exact, but let's say that very few human rights are absolute. Most human rights are balanced in the sense that one has the right to enjoy his fundamental rights, but it is not an absolute right. You have to consider the rights of others. You have to consider the rights of the community. You have to consider other values like national security, national health. So, very often, there's a conflict between the individual right and other rights, mostly community rights or individual rights. So what happens when you have, I have the right to freedom of expression, but you have the right to a reputation? There's a conflict. Can I say Dr. Bencini is a gun runner? You're not. No evidence yet. What I mean to say is that all these rights very often come in conflict with other rights. And that is where the proportionality or the balancing comes in. And the court has to make this rather subjective test. What is worse, restraining one right or restraining the other right? Which gets the best result if I give more weight to one right rather than to the other? And then you factor in all the elements in favor and against and make a test of proportionality. Now, this admittedly is an extremely subjective test, because if for me, let's say, the environment is extremely important, I will consider your right to build on your own land to be limited by the right of the butterflies and the spiders to be on that land. And I'm not saying this to be facetious. I'm saying that really depends on what you value most. If you're a traditionalist, you will find you will give more weight instinctively to what preserves rather than what changes. The end result is that virtually all cases are decided to some extent by reference to proportionality, to factoring in all the competing interests and then trying to find out whether one result or the opposite result will have more value or less harm than the other. Very difficult. Sometimes when you're in a discussion about what you should factor in, the equation for one side and for the other, and you realize that if you are 7 or 17 judges, as they are in Strasbourg, there are 17 different criteria to apply.
What significance do you attribute to the expression a living instrument, or the other twin expression, evaluative interpretation, that are so often found in the judgments delivered by the court? Does the court revise the standards of interpretation according to what the current European consensus within the member states is?
Yes and no. As all my listeners here know, The convention is a set of very, very dry, small precepts, one line each, not more than that, which were conceived in 1950. Today we're no longer in 1950, we are in 2011. And so many things have changed. Social conditions, economic conditions, communications, everything has changed. So an evolutive interpretation means that you try to change not in accordance with original intent, which is one of the theories of how you interpret an instrument. What was the original intent? Which is a safe, there are many judges of the American Supreme Court who are very great sticklers. What did they mean in 1790 or whatever the date was when they established this precept? What did they mean then? That is doctrine of original intent. The court, not everybody is very happy with it. The test is different. What would the drafters of the convention have meant by that particular precept in the year 2010, not in the year 1560? And that, of course, brings a lot about this evolution, because we know that things change. This links up to some extent with what I said before. What I said about majority consent, or European consent. There were times when, in 1950, less than a quarter of, maybe around a quarter, of European states had divorce. Today, virtually all European states have divorce, so the court would be pretty archaic if it said, no, in 1950, we decided X. But since then, it evolved. So have precepts of morality, which is the other yardstick, which I mentioned before, the margin of appreciation. The margin of appreciation, what was considered to be unacceptable, morally unacceptable, if it has evolved enormously, then it is silly to say, because in 1950 bikinis were not allowed on the street. Today you can criminalize bikinis on a beach. The evolutive interpretation, I always use the same example, if you've heard me, it's very boring. The rights of post-operative transsexuals. The case has come before the court three times. A person who has changed his sex post-operatively, is she entitled as a fundamental right to have his new gender identity acknowledged by the state? Big question mark. And there were three leading cases, all UK cases. The first case, I don't remember the names, but Tonya would probably know them better than me. The first Cossie and Godwin, I think, whatever. The ones I have in mind, there was a French case too, but the ones I have in mind to illustrate graphically the evolutive interpretation was the first case, say, 20 years ago. Cossie. The first case, the court decided virtually unanimously that transsexuals have no such right. The first action failed by very, very, if not unanimously, the court was almost unanimous in finding that transsexuals have no right to have their new gender recognized by the state. The second case, say 10 years later, exactly the same issue arose, and the court was divided 49-51. Again, no violation. They confirmed the previous judgment by which the court had not found a violation, but this time it wasn't unanimous. It was a very, very sharply split court. Virtually, we're talking of 51% and 49%. The third case, 10 years later, the court found unanimously that the non-recognition is a violation. The non-recognition of the new gender is a violation. So that gives you an example of how in, say, 20 years, the court literally stood on its head, and what before was a clear no became a clear yes. Is this fickleness? Is this inconsistency? No, it is just when post-operative transsexuals were the freaks. They were the exception. They were the ones that hit the headlines as these unfortunate freaks. When it became realized and accepted by society that these are human beings who have gone through this operation, extremely painful, both physically and psychologically, when there was much more consciousness, the court would have been stupid in saying 20 years or 30 years ago, I said that and that's it. No. The court used its common sense. It used its sensitivity to changing conditions, where post-operative transsexuals are no longer nature's freaks, but they are people who have had a drama to go through and went through it to be true to their own selves, and acknowledge that. And today, the whole of Europe has in place the right mechanisms to accept post-operative transsection. That's to answer your question, whether what is an evolutive interpretation. Of course, not everybody agrees. There are many jurists who do not believe that the convention or the constitution should be interpreted, applied according to present mores, but according to the original mores. I don't belong to that class.
And then there are new practices like surveillance, eavesdropping, which definitely were not contemplated in 1950.
Yeah.
That's why we say a living instrument as well.
Yes, yes, yes. This reminds me of a case which came from the UK. I don't know whether it's decided, but anyway, I'll tell you just the case. A case about libel on internet, which internet, of course, as you know, is a relatively recent development, technological. The point was whether a post stays on internet for a certain time, whether the prescriptive period runs from when it was placed on the internet or whether it's continuing. And the British courts decided this case by reference to a judgment of 1844, which I find rather bizarre, an issue which was created by this revolution in communications, which is the internet. The court should rely on some foggy wisdom of the 1844s to say, well, this is the situation, because since 1844, that's the way we looked at it. This again shows you that, in my view, when there is progress and when there is change, maybe it's not progress, when there is change, the legal norms should respond to that change. For me, it's crazy to apply a law which was contemplated for newspapers which were set by hand, type by type, and then printed by hand, to think that the same rules should apply for a newspaper printed manually to something which is conceptually revolutionary. So, yes, I believe that human rights law, being the mirror of human beings, being what human beings are most intimately linked with, should go hand in hand with all things that change the nature of communication, of social living, yes.
Earlier on, you mentioned Article 2 and the right to life, which is naturally one of the most important convention rights. What is meant by a substantive violation, or what is the distinction between a substantive violation and a procedural violation?
Yep. This links with what I was saying before. Article 3, Article 2 have, again, it's jurisprudence, it's the case law that has invented this distinction. A substantive violation is the taking away of the life. If the state or its agents take away a person's life illegally, then there is a substantive violation. The procedural violation is what is the result of that, because there are ancillary duties, not only not to take the life, but to investigate. If the state does not investigate, or the investigation is a cover-up, or the investigation is done negligently, deliberately or not deliberately, then there is, besides the substantial violation, the procedural violation. Because procedurally, the state is under an obligation to investigate thoroughly, impartially, to go to the bottom of any taking of life or any breach of Article 3, which is torture, inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment.
Article 3, which we are just speaking about right now, guarantees protection against inhuman and degrading treatment, and is said to comprise a three-tier level of gravity. How does the court apply this article in practice?
Article 3, like Article 2, is another of the core rights, which is the right not to be subjected to torture, to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. So, obviously, there is the substantial violation, which is torture, which is subjection to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. That is the basic. But then there are other levels of protection. One, that the court must have, that the state must have in place the mechanisms to prevent torture, to prevent inhuman degrading treatment or punishment. The state must have in place mechanisms that once these happen, they are properly investigated. The culprits are brought to punishment. Those are all levels of protection. The fact that there has been a torture, it is not enough, we have said this repeatedly, that the person is compensated, or the victims of the person, or the relatives of the person are compensated. It's not enough. Some states say, okay, there was something went wrong. No, you have to find the culprits and bring them to justice. That is part of the protection of Articles 2 and 3.
I also remember a case where the European Court decided that it was not enough for a state to have in place a civil remedy, mm-hmm. but the state is required to have a criminal remedy, yes. The case of the baby that was killed.
Yeah, that is more or less what I was saying before. Some states tried to shrug off responsibility, say, oh, but you can sue for damages, the state will give you, or the culprit will give you money, and no, it's not enough. There has to be also a criminal remedy. Criminal remedy meaning, we're talking of extreme cases of Article 2 and 3. A criminal remedy is there to ensure a deterrent, and it's made to send a clear signal that abusing Article 2 and 3 does not pay. It is not enough that the taxpayer compensates the victim. The perpetrator has to be made to feel the pinch of his wrongdoing.
You have struggled to put pressure on the court to apply a lower standard of proof in cases when an individual who has been subjected to torture or degrading and inhuman treatment in the place of custody brings a case against the state. How far have you been successful in the situation?
Let's put it the other way around. Somebody else will blow my trumpet, not me. No, unfortunately, the UK way of looking at things was proof beyond reasonable doubt, which is a perfect standard for criminal offences. I do not send anybody to jail unless I have proof beyond reasonable doubt. And the British jurists somehow convinced the court that anybody who brings a case before Strasbourg has to have proof beyond reasonable doubt. Otherwise, the state goes scot-free, which is absolutely negative to the very scope of the convention. We know a torture scenario. It's five bullies who are torturing a person who is on his own. Sometimes the torture is clever and leaves no physical signs. To expect that a person who is in these circumstances, that he has to just forget about the torture because he does not have six witnesses that he was actually tortured. There is no witness to torture. The torture is always, it's always performed secretly. It's always denied. There's in place always a system which favors the torturer rather than the victim. And yes, since you asked, Tonio, I put in a couple of very strong dissents, I think, about this. And saying that the court should not apply the standard of beyond reasonable doubt. That is a standard for criminal convictions. It's not a standard for civil findings of truth or untruth. It should apply other tests, like the balance of probabilities. I proposed another test in a case. I'll explain very briefly the balance of credibility. This was a case, a Turkish case, where a woman who had no criminal record, absolutely nothing to put her integrity in question, and she claimed she was arrested. She was the wife of a human rights activist. The police tortured her and let her go. She sued for torture in Turkey. You don't have to ask me what the result was, and she came to Strasbourg. And the court said, she hasn't proved it beyond reasonable doubt. And one of my arguments was, hold on, these are the Turkish security forces, who the court has for 100 times found guilty of perjury, of murder, of rape, of kidnap, of wiping out whole villages. And there is this woman on her own. So, is the court prepared to give more credibility to these people who have repeatedly certified to be liars, to be torturers, to be murderers? Do we give more credibility to that and not to this lady because she was on her own? Anyway, the end result was that today the standard has been abandoned. The standard of beyond reasonable doubt has been abandoned, and the new judgments have, I believe, taken on board a lot of the way I thought they should be decided.
You have also successfully imprinted in the case law of the court a finding of a violation of Article 14 concerning discrimination in cases of political killings, especially where the victim was a Rom, and you were congratulated on the internet on that. How did this important development come about?
Again, I'll have to go one step further, backwards. The court has repeatedly, hundreds of times, found killings, murder, rapes, torture, violence against minority groups, repeatedly. But never up to 19 or 2001, never once was the court convinced that this was due to minority prejudice. Even a case which I'm ashamed to say, a Rom was killed in Bulgaria, and while he was being killed, the policeman said, "Have it, you dirty gypsy." Bam! And died. And the court said, yes, there is a killing. Definitely there's a violation of Article 2. There's a killing. But we are not convinced that it was racially motivated. I mean, I don't have a lot of hair to pull, but that is an occasion when I was rather regretted I didn't have. And I did again write a dissent, I think a very strong one, saying that this is crazy. You cannot have, or rather, my argument was that if the killing or the torture is made in a context of racial prejudice, it is for the state to prove that it was not motivated racially. It's not for the individual to prove that it was motivated racially. There has to be a shift in the burden of evidence in favor of the individual. I am killed in an area where gypsies are killed regularly by the police. I'm killed where the rate of gypsy killings or of other killings, but we're talking of gypsies here, is far higher than anywhere else. It's not for me to prove that I was killed accidentally because my face wasn't nice. I was killed in a gypsy hate-loaded circumstance. It's for the state to prove that that particular killing was not racially motivated. And yes, I think thankfully this situation has now been accepted, and since then there have been a good number of cases where the court not only found a finding of a violation of Articles 2 and 3, but also finally, after 50 years, that this didn't happen accidentally. It happened because they were gypsies, because they were minority people who were targeted for particular hate.
There have been cases in Malta concerning the right to the peaceful enjoyment of property before the European Court. Several requisition orders and expropriations have failed the Strasbourg test after having been successfully defended by the government before the local courts.
Yeah.
Why do you think that the Maltese courts condone such obvious violations?
Tony, I'm not in a position to read why. The fact is that there were some very obvious imbalances between the rights of owners and the rights of non-owners. Ownership, private ownership, is a fundamental right in Malta. And repeatedly the courts here always found that everything was hunky-dory. Perfectly all right, there was nothing wrong with the rent laws, there was nothing wrong with the requisition laws, there was nothing wrong with this, nothing wrong with that. Until the case came to Strasbourg. What I am amazed is that it took them so long for Maltese lawyers to get a case to Strasbourg on the property laws. In fact, since then there have been 3, 4, 5 cases, and they've been walkovers. I mean, the court there they were in difficult case. It had to be the Strasbourg court to drum into our legislators, our social conscience, that a right is not a paper right, it is a real right. When you have a right of ownership that actually not only entails no benefit for the owner, but imposes liabilities on the owner. I mean, a place is requisitioned, I'm paid £5 a year, and I have to change the roofs. If they're leaking, it's my obligation to spend £5,000, £20,000 to change the roofs of the places. And then I am the owner. And this is called the enjoyment of the fundamental right to property.
At a meeting held in Nashar in 1987, before the opening of Parliament in 1987, you suggested to the future Prime Minister, in my presence, I had the privilege to be present that day, that it would be appropriate to incorporate the European Convention on Human Rights into Maltese law as the very first act of the new Parliament. How do you evaluate the significance of that momentous development in Maltese human rights law?
Without wanting to be political, 1987 was a year that really changed a lot of things. And the new government in 1987 had in mind to make a statement that things are now different. And we were discussing informally, I believe, I mean, your memory is better than mine, which way to herald the new vision of governance, of democracy. And maybe in a moment of craziness, I said, why don't we have the very first act of Parliament should be a law that makes the European Convention of Human Rights enforceable in Malta directly and part of the Maltese legal system. The idea was liked. As usual, you pay a price for being smarmy, and the Prime Minister ordered me to draft the European Convention Act, which I drafted and which was eventually approved, I believe, unanimously in Parliament. I'm not sure whether it was unanimous, but anyway, it was. So the very first act after 1987 was this law to make the standards of European human rights, good living, part, enforceable as part of the laws of Malta. Yes, it had a great significance, not only symbolic. I mean, mostly it was, I believe, a symbolic act to say, look, this is our statement. We want things from now onwards to be not what the minister thinks best, but what human rights demand. And that is what happened, and I take a little pride in that.
To go with that, there was the right of individual petition, which was introduced also in 1987,
yeah,
a little earlier. What has the Maltese citizen gained as a result of this other major development?
The Maltese citizen has gained in practice and in theory. In theory, he now has a higher tier of protection. Before, the highest tier was the Constitutional Court, which did some good work, but as I said before, maybe not always. Now, if the Constitutional Court fails, there is another catchment, another safety net for human rights. There is, so that is in general. In practice, Malta's acceptance of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights has translated something we've already mentioned, the D'Amicoli case. I mean, before D'Amicoli, it was normal for journalists to be hauled before Parliament and threatened with imprisonment and with fines. And with, since then, it stopped, full stop. That was the European Court of Human Rights. That was the subscription to the European Convention of Human Rights. We've had the property cases. We've had a number of interesting Article 6 cases, fair trial. For example, before, I guess there are lawyers here, before, when you instituted a case of rehearing, of rehearing, ritrattazioni, the law said that it could be heard by the same judges who had given the same the previous judgment. That is, I am challenging its judgment because the judges misunderstood the law. The judges applied the wrong law. The judges made a fools of themselves. And it comes in front of the same judges who have to say, oh yes, of course, I was an idiot, I misunderstood the law. And in fact, what happened was that not a single ritrattazione based on error of law was ever successful, because it came in front of the same judges. Of course, this was challenged in Strasbourg, and the court there said, what the hell, what are we talking about? They are judging themselves, they are not judging the party, they are judging their own judgment. So, out. We've had a number of Article 6 cases. For example, injunction proceedings. Injunction proceedings, there was this idea, even in Strasbourg, I must say, that injunction proceedings do not carry the fair trial guarantees, which means the judge can impose an injunction, ruin your business, ruin your family life, but he can be a non-independent and non-impartial judge. There's nothing wrong with that, we said, because it's an injunction proceeding. So if I have a car hire business and I have an injunction not to hire cars anymore, and I go bankrupt, it can be done. There's nothing wrong. It can be done by a judge who's not independent or impartial. He can be the brother of my client, of the plaintiff. He can be. This was taken to Strasbourg, and the court there decided that even injunction proceedings, in most cases, attract the guarantees of a fair trial, of a fair hearing and a fair trial.
What binding force does the case law of the European Court have in Malta now that we have incorporated the convention?
Look, I think Malta always tried to follow the European case law. The penalty for not doing it is that the case is then taken to Strasbourg, and the court there says, "Oi, you have failed to follow the precepts of the convention as interpreted by the case law." So there is always that. But the truth is that our courts do make an effort to apply Strasbourg case law the way they understand it. Sometimes I must admit that the case law is not all that clear and not all that easy to interpret. But generally and genuinely, there is this desire of the local courts to keep themselves updated with what comes out of Strasbourg and to apply it. Now, whether they're successful in doing it depends on individual cases. Sometimes they are, other times less.
If member states treat the judgments of the European Court as a reason to amend or repeal national legislation with a view to complying with their obligation under Article 1 of the Convention, do we have a problem in Malta? What happens after there's a court pronouncement?
Yes. In Malta, we have a problem, because the attitude has sometimes been that a judgment of the Constitutional Court or of the European Court of Human Rights is only binding for the two parties who are involved. So if I ask for a declaration from the Constitutional Court that a certain law is not valid because it conflicts with the European Convention of Human Law, and I win that case, the attitude of the Maltese legislator has been, oh yes, it's not valid for you, you were the plaintiff, but it's valid for everybody else. Again, this, I don't want to be disrespectful, I think this is pure nonsense. If a law is declared to be incompatible with the European Convention of Human Laws, it is incompatible. And the Convention says expressly that any law, Article 6, which is incompatible with the provisions of the European Convention is null and void. It doesn't say is nullable vis-a-vis X or Y, who are plaintiffs in the case. So there we have a problem. And we've seen this problem also with the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Although I don't believe there has been any public statement, and in general, the Maltese government and other governments try to conform, they don't take it as automatic. They think, okay, so Dr. Bencini won his case, we pay him damages, and the law doesn't apply as far as he's concerned. But it applies to Dr. Soller, to Dr. Azapardi, to Professor Aquilina. And this is something which is extremely serious, I believe, this idea that law is piecemeal, it can be valid for you and null for somebody else, is beyond the pale. Yes.
Briefly, human rights apply in a vertical relationship between the state and the individual. When a violation of one of the substantive rights is perpetrated by a private individual to the detriment of another private individual, is there anything beyond ordinary remedies?
Yes, Tonio, this again is a difficult question. Human rights are what the state is obliged to respect. So the fundamental relationship between state and individual. It is the state that is bound to respect them. It is the state that violates them. So a human rights action is on principle against the state. But there is also what is known as Drittvölkung. I won't be very technical about it. There are cases where the human right is violated by an individual, but the state is responsible for that violation. Why? Because it had a system of encouraging violations by individuals, so it's the state that is encouraging it, or by not having in place civil or criminal legislation that prohibits that violation by the individuals, and so the state vicariously carries responsibility for a violation committed by an individual. That is the main difference. Classical human rights are those who can only be violated by the state. But in exceptional circumstances, if the state becomes an accomplice by an action, by action, and the result of this action or inaction of the state is that violation of human rights is made easier by individuals, then the state carries responsibility.
My final question. On the 22nd of December 2009, the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights delivered its judgment in the case Sejdic and Finci versus Bosnia and Herzegovina. In your dissenting opinion, you stated, and I quote, "I would be the first to want the court not to be too small for its ideals. I would be the last to want the court to be too big for its boots. The court has not found a hazard of civil war, the avoidance of carnage, or the safeguard of territorial cohesion to have sufficient social value to justify some limitation on the rights of the two applicants. I do not identify with this. I cannot endorse a court that sows ideals and harvests massacre." What values were at stake in this case?
Well, this is strong words, huh? Yeah. This is Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bosnia-Herzegovina had come out of a terrible civil war. There were three entities, there were three ethnic entities, the Bosniaks, which are the Muslims, the Croats, and the Serbs, traditionally always at each other's throat. The moment Bosnia-Herzegovina became independent, there was civil war with the Croats, Croatia supporting the Croats, the Serbs supporting the Serbs, and rivers of blood were running. Eventually, the international community intervened, and the Dayton Agreement was hammered out. Now, the Dayton Agreement is not a perfect agreement. The new constitution of Bosnia is held together by the Dayton Agreement, by which the rights of the three communities are very, very, very finely balanced. All the raison d'etre of the Dayton Agreement was that a fine systems of checks and balances between the three warring communities should be in place to avoid a repetition of the massacres that took place before. Now, unfortunately, in the Dayton Agreement, two minorities were left out, which are the Romas and the Jews. There are small Hebrew minorities, the Jewish minorities, and Roma minorities, which were not included in this very, very fine equation of sharing of power. And the Roms and the Jews are prohibited from, not from voting, but for standing for certain particular type of public function. And, of course, they were upset. And they brought a case to the court saying the right to stand for election is a fundamental human right. It is. It's one of the least important fundamental human rights because it can be limited by any number of exceptions. And they said, we want the right to. In other words, they said, we want to scrap the Dayton Agreement because we want to stand for election. And the majority found in their favor. And I was very worried because upsetting a balance which had been set up by international consensus and which had worked more or less because two particular individuals did not have the right to stand for mayor or for something or other, was too dangerous, was too risky a risk to take. And I don't want to say I'm being proved right. Bosnia-Herzegovina is again on the verge of very, very grave problems. At the moment you pull the carpet from under something rickety, that's going to collapse. And the Dayton Agreement, in my view, was anything but perfect, but saved the country from a certain civil war. Now, that a court should interfere in something in which, in an international treaty, in which not even the signatories are members of the court, United States, for example, is not. Does the court have the jurisdiction to change an international treaty in which the parties are not even before the court, like the United Nations? Big question mark. I don't know the answer to it, but it's certainly something to consider. Does the court have the right to safeguard the right? Remember, the right to stand for election is one of the least protected rights. It can be limited for a number of reasons, of residence, of nationality, of age, of criminal record. There are 100 reasons. Shouldn't it be limited also when the risk of standing for election is causing a national massacre? That was my question.
Saying that this interview has been enlightening, interesting, instructive is an understatement. Thank you, Judge Bonello, for being here with us and for your extremely incisive answers.
Not too difficult and not too nasty, please.
Joe Rosso.
Yes.
My question is, how big is the jurisdiction of the court? Does it go beyond the member states of the European community?
Yes. The answer is that this is not the court of the European Union. It is the court of the Council of Europe. European Union is 24, 27, how much is it
27.
Now? 27. This is 47. 20 states which are not in the European Union, but which are in the Council of Europe, are subscribers to the convention and therefore clients of the court.
I see. Thank you.
It seems that human rights law is largely based on discretion, in my opinion, different from other areas of law. How do you categorize, for example, inhuman treatment, degrading treatment, or, for example, suspicious death, in your opinion, or freedom of expression? There are different boundaries according to different opinions, or different morality and ethical principles of the judge concerned. How do you view this, having practiced human rights law, from the point of view of a lawyer, and then from the point of view of a judge having to decide on case?
I cannot deny that the European Convention of Human Rights is not the weights and measures ordinance. It is not something definable by a precise definition. But the court has been in existence for 60 years, and there is a huge amount of case law which has addressed your problems. So that what was you call the word discretionary, and I won't fight with that, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, today is very well defined. Of course, it varies. For example, a definition of torture, the convention says torture. When there was the Irish cases, shamefully, it was decided that the five techniques used by the UK forces on suspects, on Irish suspects, did not amount to torture. They were very, very harsh methods of interrogation, but the court then, in 1960 or whatever it was, said, yes, but this is not torture. In Salmoni, the question was revisited, and it was decided that even less invasive and less cruel and less painful methods of interrogation amount to torture. That says you're right to a certain extent, but today we have a definition of torture. Salmoni went into great detail to define what is on the right side of the bright line and what is on the wrong side of the bright line. And today, it is no longer a matter of discretion. It was before the Irish cases. After the Irish cases, there was case law. For me, it was absolutely unacceptable case law, but there was a case law. And today, there is certainty. Today, certain acts are, by definition, torture. This applies to freedom of expression. It applies you mentioned other concepts, which are the right to family life. It has evolved enormously. We were mentioning positive obligations before. At first, family life was the state must not interfere with family life. And that was all right. Now, the state has a positive obligation to promote family life, to promote family reunions, to promote the rights of parents to have access, to have control of the children's life. There has been evolution, undoubtedly. To call it discretion, maybe it is, but discretion is slightly different. Discretion is, legally, it is when an authority has a number of options and chooses within the parameters of the law and chooses one rather than choose another, and that is typical administrative discretion. In this case, I don't think it is the same form of discretion. If you take subjectivity, basically, every law is what the judge thinks it is. It sounds conceited, but even human rights are what the court in Strasbourg thinks they are. Of course, you assume that 47 judges chosen by a good process of choice will not be capricious, will not render discretionary judgments, but they will always try to base it on reason, on logic, on social considerations. They use their discretion wisely, in that sense.
Thank you very much once again.
You have just listened to a lecture organized by the Department of Public Law. This was an interview which Judge Dr. Giovanni Bonello gave to Dr. Tonio Azzopardi.